Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos.
Good morning. Welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft, is at the controls. In this second hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the health of the oceans. And we have as our guest Julia Whitty. She's a documentary filmmaker. She's been making documentaries, nature documentaries now for something like 25 years, with particular interest and specialty in underwater films. She is the author of a featured article that you can find in the new issue of Mother Jones magazine, looking at some of the things that she's learned over the time that she's been doing this kind of work. And she is one of those, and certainly there are many, many environmentalists and scientists and others who are very concerned about the health of the ocean and about the possibility that human activity has changed the life in the ocean, and indeed that could mean something significant for the entire planet. And you can go and you can read the article on the newsstand. She's the author of a book entitled A Tortoise for the Queen of Tonga, which was a finalist for the Penn Hemingway Award. She's won some other awards for her work. And she's also the author of a new book, not yet published, though one that will be coming out, titled There Are Many Souls Embodied in Water, Tales from the Coral World, which is about coral reefs. Questions, of course, are welcome here as we talk, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point, if you have questions, comments, you can call us. All we ask of people who call in is that people just are brief, and we ask that so that we can get in as many different people as possible and keep the program moving along. But, of course, anybody who is listening is welcome to call in and join the conversation. Ms. Whitty, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, just ask me. Let me ask you just sort of generally, I'm curious about how it is you got interested in doing nature documentaries and specifically how it is that now I guess you've spent a lot of time on the water and also under the water.
Well, I was always interested in working in field biology and being out in natural places, and I actually began by kind of studying that and got something of a scientific grounding in that, but I realized field biologists often return to the same place for their whole lives, and there's something beautiful in that, but I also felt I wanted to see more of the world, and I knew that if I could get into filmmaking on these natural history subjects, I'd probably be able to see a lot of the really fantastic natural parts of the world. So there really wasn't any school to go for you to learn how to do this. It's just a matter of kind of finagling your way and shooting film and presenting it and hoping somebody will eventually buy it, which is what happened.
The generally, this topic, the health of the ocean, it seems to me that if you look at various kinds of environmental stories that you see generally in the news, that from time to time you do see something about the ocean. But it seems to me that there are other things that get a lot more of attention. And occasionally something will happen. For example, there was this major report that was done by the Pew Oceans Commission now, I guess, about 3 years ago that certainly got attention. And there, I believe, there also was a kind of a parallel or at about the same time there was a federal government report. And there is probably the one thing that we do hear about is the problems of overfishing. But having said that, it seems to me that this is a story that doesn't get a lot of attention, or at least other environmental subjects seem to get more. And I'm curious if you in fact think that that's true, and why do you think that that's true?
I do think that's true. I mean, you know, 7/10 of our planet is ocean, and yet it gets probably 1/10 or less of our attention. And I think, sadly, because we can't penetrate most of it, we barely see it. Even if we stand on a coastline, we're looking about 3 miles out to sea at the horizon point. And most of what goes on out there goes on outside of our view. And that's one of the reasons why a lot of this bad policy and things that we do and some of the bad stuff we do to the ocean, we can actually get away with. We do things to the ocean we could no longer get away with doing on land, but there's nobody out there to see. There's nobody out there to raise a ruckus about it.
Yeah, I think that points to a couple of things. I think one perhaps is the understandable but maybe understandably short-sighted notion that the ocean is so big and so vast that anything that we would do would get swallowed up, and so it wouldn't really matter. And the other is that it's the problem of the commons, you know, that it has to be regarded as a common resource, and yet people maybe pay more attention to what goes on in coastal waters, but when you get out into the open ocean, it's, on the one hand, it belongs to everybody, but on the other hand, it belongs to nobody. So there really is no one that is policing it. And maybe no good international bodies that are in a very good position to actually to have any kind of influence over what nations do out in the open ocean.
That's true, and it really shows that our thinking hasn't really evolved to the point yet, or at least our action hasn't evolved to the point yet, where we've learned how to manage these common areas. So we see problems in the ocean. The other place we see this commons problems is in the atmosphere. So the two big environmental problem places on planet Earth right now are the atmosphere and the ocean. These are two deeply ingrained systems that are totally interconnected to one another. What you do in the atmosphere affects the ocean and vice versa. These are together the life support system of our planet, and yet we really aren't in any way yet able to handle managing these or overseeing them in a responsible fashion.
There has certainly in the media there has been a lot written about temperature rise, global temperature rise, and how much that has been and why it has been, and is that some result of a temporary sort of swing, or is that something that we're likely to see continue? So we're talking about surface temperature. There is also a kind of a parallel concern about the increase in the temperature of the water and what that might mean. What do we know now about what's happening with the ocean temperature?
We do know that ocean temperatures are rising. That's pretty much within respectable scientific circles, that's acknowledged, as it is with the atmosphere, that the global temperatures are rising, and that is beginning to affect many aspects of our planetary system. So, for instance, in the last few years, scientists have been really startled by the rapidity with which the ice caps are melting. Your listeners have probably heard how quickly the Arctic is melting, and scientists really thought Antarctica just was a well of cold that would be impervious for a long time to this. But in fact, we're starting to see very alarming signs of melting in the Antarctic. And they're beginning to realize that one of the reasons this melting is going on so quickly is because the ice is being attacked from two directions. It's being attacked from above by warming air masses, and it's being attacked from below by warming oceans. And so it's being nibbled at both directions, and it's leading to very rapid ice loss throughout the globe.
Mm-hmm.
This is a real problem with global. The other problem with changing temperature within the ocean is, you know, we think there are these separate oceans called Pacific, Atlantic, and Indian, but in fact, oceanographers recognize that there's really one world ocean, and it is connected by something they call the ocean conveyor belt. And this is a series of currents. One of the better known currents would be, for instance, the Gulf Stream. Some of these currents run at the surface, and some traveled way down deep at 15,000, 20,000 feet deep, and they often run counter to the surface currents. And these actually circulate waters across the entire ocean basin, so that a drop of rain that falls in the North Atlantic will actually eventually travel south, circle Antarctica, and emerge in the North Pacific 1,200 years later. From there, it will eventually work its way back to the North Atlantic. So the ocean is connected, and we know that what runs this ocean conveyor belt that connects the ocean in this fashion is temperature and salinity of the water, and those two things are connected. And as we warm the atmosphere and warm the ocean, we actually begin to affect salinity. Obviously, salinity is affected because we're melting ice caps and putting a lot more fresh water in. As we warm the atmosphere, we're actually creating more precipitation, which is also putting more fresh water in. So we're in danger of changing this ocean conveyor belt system, which has happened at times in Earth's past, and we know that at times when the ocean conveyor belt system has either slowed or broken down, that the Earth has undergone massive climate change very rapidly.
This is the kind of thing that it may be a little easy. There's an illustration in the magazine that goes with the article that helps you sort of understand exactly what it is that you're talking about. This series of currents that go all around, they loop, they go up and down. The important thing is that at some points they go deep, so it's colder. Then it comes up to the surface so that it's warmer. And depending upon where that's happening and where the colder water is and where the warmer water is, it has definite effects on conditions on the land as well. One of them being the thing that you pointed to is that if you get warmer water and you get it around the areas where we have the polar caps, then that's just going to facilitate warming and melting. And it seems sort of hard to believe when you think the ocean is so big that somehow melting some polar ice would make very much difference in how salty the water is, but it is indeed possible that you could change the salinity if you do enough melting of that ice, because that's fresh water. So that means you're dumping fresh water into the salt.
And not only that, but there's this whole business of the reflectiveness of planet Earth. So where we have ice cover, obviously a lot of the sun's rays are reflected back into space. As that white ice cover melts away and becomes dark ocean, it actually absorbs more sun rays and actually creates an even a stronger feedback loop of making the oceans even warmer. The warmer oceans create more water vapor, which in turn create more precipitation. So not only are you getting increased fresh water from melting ice, but that melting ice is actually creating more rainfall. So that's another addition to, which is all running off into rivers, which are flowing into the ocean and increasing the freshness of the ocean that way.
Yeah, so that's one of the reasons one might be concerned about the melting of polar caps is not simply increase in sea level, although this, depending on how high you are, that could be a real serious problem. But yet another aspect to it is this change in just how salty the salt water is.
Absolutely, and those affect the chemistry. That chemistry of the ocean is what actually runs the ocean conveyor belt. As you change chemistry, which is happening, we are causing that to happen, we affect the ocean conveyor belt. Now, British researchers this past December actually found the first evidence that one critical area of this ocean conveyor belt, which is a subsurface current, has slowed by about 30% very rapidly in the last about 5 years. So this is an area that they have been monitoring since, I think, 1958 and has been maintaining stability, but just suddenly it has gone and slowed by 30%. So that is very alarming news for the future of what we see happening in the ocean conveyor belt and what that would mean for us living on land.
Well, what, for example, just for those people there, what would that mean, or what do they think that might mean?
Well, again, it's the first signs of instability in a system. And the point I make in this article, I'd like to also mention that this article in Mother Jones Magazine can be read online at motherjones.com if anybody would like to look at that. But, we've been actually, there's a lot in the ocean conveyor belt that we've been looking at for a long time, and we know that it has created this very stable system on the planet. It's the stability that really enabled our species to evolve, and it's certainly one that's enabled our civilization to rise to where it is now. When we start creating instability in that system, we run the risk of undermining our own society. We've certainly seen in the past that great societies, even Mayan societies and things that have undergone large climate change, have disappeared. And it's possible even for us. So we need to really be wary about just accepting these changes. We need to be proactive about recognizing the impact they might have. And one of last year's, of course, incredible hurricane season, a lot of researchers are beginning to realize is most likely an effect of the warming ocean. These large hurricanes, more of them and bigger of them than were ever seen before. Hurricane Wilma towards the end of the season was actually exceeded the scale as we know it of the Category 5. And technically it should have been a Category 6 hurricane, but we don't even have a Category 6. And so scientists are beginning to call for a revised scale to reflect the fact that these warmer oceans are growing bigger hurricanes. This obviously has a huge impact. We see what happened to New Orleans, and we know that with forecast sea level rise from the melting of these ice caps, the levee system we're talking about making could be rather irrelevant, and not only for New Orleans, but for large parts of the coastal world, which frequently is the big urban centers of our world, are likely to be flooded and inundated in the coming years.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Julia Witte. She's a documentary filmmaker and has been making nature documentaries for the past 25 years, specializing in underwater films. She has authored an article that you can read in the current issue of Mother Jones Magazine, which is on the newsstands, or as she says, you can go to their website and you can read it there. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455, and we do have a couple of people here ready to go. Someone nearby in Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. I'd like to point out something here, and I don't want to get too terribly technical in this, but it's going to have to be just a little bit. Our atmosphere contains between 300 and 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide. A portion of that has been increased here recently by human beings and human activity. Burning coal, whatever, however you want to figure it out. And that has started us on this greenhouse effect and started rising the temperature of the ocean. But we don't really talk too much about another aspect that is involved exactly with this warming aspect. If you take a bottle of pop and you start warming it up, the carbon dioxide that's inside that pop that makes it fizzy gets more and more pressure and wants to come out because water doesn't hold as much carbon dioxide when it gets warmer. So as we warm this atmosphere up, we're going to start forcing more and more carbon dioxide out of the ocean, which is a much larger reservoir of carbon dioxide than what we are actually putting into the atmosphere. So this problem of ours is going to just keep generating over and over on itself. It's something we should definitely be thinking about.
Yeah, I appreciate that. That's a very good observation. And there are a lot of these feedback loops that we're kind of in the middle of here. There's another reality that we're facing as we warm the ocean, and that's the knowledge that at the bottom of the oceans is a lot of frozen methane, which exists in a stable state down there as long as our oceans are in a pretty frozen state. But we know that at times past in Earth's history where the oceans have warmed, suddenly all of this methane has gone liquid, has risen, gone gaseous and risen up through the ocean, emerged into the atmosphere from the surface, and had massive and rapid, you know, global warming as a result of this gigantic infusion of methane into the environment. That's a possibility here. We don't know where the break point is on this. We just know that it's happened in the past. But every time, you know, the point I make in this Mother Jones article is every time we change the parameters, which we're doing pretty thoughtlessly at the moment, we are basically introducing a big game of Russian roulette, and we really don't know when that bullet's going to go off.
Exactly. Carbon dioxide, water, and methane are all very, very strong greenhouse gases that tend to trap heat within our atmosphere that we should be worried about a very great deal. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Right, thanks for the call. Others are welcome. 333-9455. That's for people who might be listening here in Champaign-Urbana where we are. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Someone off the air just was wondering about whether you had seen the film The Day After Tomorrow. And in fact, you mentioned it in passing in your article, and people perhaps won't remember this movie, and that it was looking at the effect some felt overdramatized of possibly a catastrophic sudden climate change as a result of the kind of things that we've already talked about. And I think that some people said, well, it was a little bit, you know, it was a Hollywood movie and it was a little bit sensationalized. The question is, could such a thing, anything like that actually happen?
It could, but on a much longer time scale than that movie allowed for. So, you know, those changes, those kinds of changes are what we're talking about when we talk about the breakdown of the ocean conveyor belt system. This change that the British team found in last December was the beginnings of that, possibly what may lead to the breakdown of that warm, basically Gulf Stream water being delivered to Northern Europe. So Northern Europe, which lies on a latitude with a lot of Alaska, but acts more like it's New York City in terms of its climate, could well be facing an Alaskan-type environment in the coming years. And in a severe scenario, there is the possibility that even despite global warming, if we break the ocean conveyor belt system down, it could even conceivably lead to the regrowing of ice caps. Nobody knows. Nobody. This is the truth. Nobody knows. It's possible. Maybe global warming will counteract that. We don't really know. All we know is we're shaking up the system. And I like this caller's analogy of the gases trapped in a bottle. You know, we had a champagne bottle here on Earth, and now we're shaking it up and we're about to uncork it. And all of that wonderful liquid that we survive on and need is going to just, we don't know what's going to happen to it. So
Let's shift and talk a little bit about another subject that you also write about. And this is one that perhaps has gotten at least some attention. And that is the depletion of global fish stocks as a result of overfishing. Tremendous demand for this product. Technology has made it possible for people who are fishing and commercially fishing to take in enormous amounts of fish to the point where certain species seem to be perhaps trembling on the brink of extinction and certainly put serious dents in a lot of others. And sometimes it's just it's incidental. It may not, in fact, even be the kind of thing that you're going after. Just how much concern is there that we're doing serious or perhaps irreparable damage to the fish stocks in the ocean?
There's very serious concern on this front. This was an area where we really did, until fairly recently, believe that the seas were infinite, and there was no way we could tap the abundance of life in the ocean. If you go back and read accounts of various mariners and things from 300 years ago, it's absolutely unbelievable what they describe in terms of the amount of life that used to be in the ocean. And what happens today is we have these three modern industrialized fisheries. They're drift netters, longliners, and trawlers. And they're the equivalent of going in and just bulldozing the ocean for everything in it. Of the total global fish catch, about 25% of what is, actually about 40% of what is caught is not what is targeted. At least 40% is not what the fishers are targeting. And 25% of that is species we don't eat, we have no use for, or they're too small to take to market. 25% of the total world fish catch is thrown overboard every year, dead or dying. This amounts to 88 billion pounds of life. That's B as in Bravo. I mean, it's an insupportable amount of life that is just completely wasted. I like to make the analogy. I mean, if we did this kind of behavior on land, first of all, we're not farming fish. We're hunting fish. We're basically going out and taking wildlife. Where else do we still do anything like that on land? So let's just say we did eat a terrestrial apex predator, which is what tuna and swordfish are. Let's say we ate lions. And the way we caught lions was to go out to the savannas in Africa and throw a huge net around the savanna and drag everything in, all, you know, stripping all the plant life out of the ground, catching all the wildebeest and antelope and meerkats and every single thing that can move. And most of it we throw away dead. That's what we're doing in the ocean. And the reason we know this is insupportable, there's just a wealth of data coming in now, but basically the world fish catch leveled off at the year 2000, possibly earlier, depending on your analysis of the numbers. And despite more hours at sea and an incredibly better fishing technology, we cannot catch what we used to catch. It simply isn't there. And there was a very seminal study done out of Nova Scotia that actually took a look at the historical records to estimate how many big fish are left in the sea, the big tuna, the big swordfish, the big sharks, the big flounders, the big halibut. And there's always been this assumption amongst fisheries managers that, you know, there's a lot of big fish out there in certain areas. And this study was able to ascertain, and this has completely revolutionized the thinking in fisheries biology, that there is less than 10% of the big fish left in the ocean. More than 90% of them are completely gone. And the members of those species that we're catching now, as the authors of this study point out, are often too young to have even reached sexual maturity. They're not even of breeding age themselves yet, and we're catching them before they can even breed and create a future generation. So this is absolutely intolerable behavior. We could never get away with doing anything like this on land, but because it goes on out in the ocean, somehow we get away with it. Now, the good news on this is fisheries biologists have a whole new way of understanding and managing fisheries. You know, in the past, well, and actually, we still do mostly single-species management, and we know this doesn't work. We know from land-based management that this doesn't work, and what's needed is an ecosystem-based approach. You don't just manage tuna stocks. You manage the whole world they live in. However, although fisheries biologists know this, fisheries managers are very slow to get on the boat. These are a lot of people, maybe, hopefully a younger generation will come in, but, I mean, is there time for us to wait for that? I don't know. So the scientists know what needs to be done. Whether we can get managers to go along with this yet, we don't know the answer to that.
Well, let's talk with another caller here. And Leroy, line number four. Hello.
Hi there. A very interesting topic. But given that the current administration, science appears to be anathema, and given that half of the population of the United States, for instance, seems to support this notion that science can be ignored, apparently at our peril, what would you suggest? What can we that we've been referring to, what can we do to elicit changes? And if it's okay, I'll hang up and listen.
All right.
That's a big question. I mean, I agree with you. I think a lot of our predicament boils down to the fact that we have a schism here. We have people who understand and value science and know what an amazing tool it offers us to manage our world. And we have other people who simply don't even believe in science. You know, one of the points I make in my article is the current administration has poo-pooed a lot of the global climate change stuff, saying, hey, we don't believe this. It's all based on computer modeling. And they say computer modeling like this is some inferior method. And as I point out in my article, we use computer models to go to war, to forecast financial markets. Pretty much everything that we do these days is done with computer modeling. And yet somehow when we come to this issue of science, environmentalism, and the future of our planet, suddenly computer modeling becomes suspect. Well, the truth is computer modeling is very, very useful, and it's the only thing that enables us to look ahead and act intelligently. So I would say, you know, what are we left with? We're left with making our voices heard to our legislators, electing people who say they will address these issues. I think we haven't made it clear enough to our elected officials that these are important issues to us. You know, I was appalled that we had a State of the Union address and a follow-up Democratic response, and never once was there a mention of any of these global environmental issues, which are the true threat to our homeland security. Hmm.
And I think also I get the impression maybe you think that perhaps also that some scientists are not speaking up about these issues the way that they should.
Well, I think we have a slightly dysfunctional system that's evolved where science and media are wary of each other. I think scientists are often leery of the media because they actually don't understand science, an awful lot of them, and they misreport a scientist's findings. Now, this is actually really important to a scientist. It can affect their future ability to get funded. It can affect their standing within a very strong peer-based community. So it's imperative that the media get it right. On the other hand, I think science has to lighten up a little bit and recognize that, you know, to some extent, when you go out to the media, you're talking to you have to talk in a more simplified fashion, and you can't allow for all the nuance that goes on in discussion among scientists. And if you want to make changes, and these scientists for the most part do, they have to develop a way to go out and address the public and the media. I think the media is responsible to a large extent for determining what the public considers to be the important issues of our day. And as long as the media barely covers these stories, the public is not going to understand how important they are.
Well, I think it's also true. I think, as you say, it's true that there are a lot of reporters who end up covering scientific stories who don't have very much background in science. So that's a problem. But I think that sometimes the way the media works is also a problem, too. And I'm not the first person and the only person to say this, that I think reporters really don't know what to do with the fact that sometimes in science there is uncertainty. There may be a weight on one side or the other. But the fact that 100% of scientists probably never say anything, I think media doesn't really, reporters don't know quite what to do with that. They don't feel that they're in a position to say, well, maybe 60% or 70% or 80% of the scientists think one thing. And they're a little unsure about saying, well, that there is, in fact, a consensus on something in the scientific community.
I think that's right. And I think it behooves scientists to address that to some extent by doing their own census and you know, delivering the media these sort of consensus numbers. I mean, I look at it now, it's not unlike decades ago with the tobacco industry, which hired its own scientists and threw a lot of bizarre data out there and basically befuddled the world for a while with sham science. And there is a certain amount of sham science that's going on right now on global climate change issues, people that are more or less in the pockets of energy industries. And, you know, those people don't deserve equal status. And the media needs to recognize that, you know, there's no point bringing a charlatan in and giving them equal weight in the reporting of this story. So the media needs to learn discernment. And I personally would hope that we would get more people coming into the media with a science background, that they could actually figure some of this stuff out and report on it well.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Julia Whitty. She is a documentary filmmaker. She's been making nature documentaries for the past 25 years, specializing in underwater films. She's the author of a book entitled A Tortoise for the Queen of Tonga, which was a finalist for the Penn Hemingway Award, written a number of years ago, and that is still available, still in print. She's working on a forthcoming book on coral reefs and is the author of a featured article in the current issue of Mother Jones magazine. It's on the newsstand now, so you can buy the magazine or you can actually go to their website, and you can read it that way. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We've been talking a bit about concerns about the health of the open ocean, and we've talked a little bit about warming, the possibility that the ocean was warming, that the salinity is changing. We've talked a little bit about fishing. Maybe one more thing as far as the open ocean is concerned, and that is the presence of pollutants. You talked about the fact that there is this conveyor belt that moves the water around the globe so that eventually anything that starts at one point will travel, given enough time, will go every place. What sort of concern is there about pollutants in the ocean and that effect on ocean life? And then I suppose then the next leap is if you eat the stuff in the ocean, then that's the potential impact on human health that way.
Yeah, we are seeing that a lot of the apex predators in the ocean, which eat all the trophic levels below them, and we have this process of bioaccumulation where toxins are being, in a sense, magnified as you move up the food chain. So the high-end predators, whether they're killer whales or tuna, are very, very heavily contaminated now with, for instance, mercury. Now, mercury is a byproduct of a lot of human industry, coal burning plants, chlorine industry, and oddly enough, even now we're realizing that as more and more people choose cremation, that the cremation of human remains and all of the mercury fillings in their mouth is actually beginning to send fairly significant amounts of mercury into the atmosphere, which then ends up in the ocean. So, and we are seeing higher levels of mercury in humans, too. I think the EPA has estimated that 1 in 6, perhaps, I'm not sure that figure, American women of childbearing age actually have unhealthy levels of mercury in their blood. And as well as mercury, there's also problems with the persistent organic things like PCBs and DDTs and some of the pesticides that are accumulating in the fatty tissues of fish and and mammals and humans. And we know that in populations that eat heavily off the high top of the marine food chain, like Inuit and Eskimo people in the Arctic, that they have very high levels of these toxins. And there's some concern that they're actually facing some problems both with their health, with their ability to reproduce. And we could be conceivably looking at the extinction of these people, which is a really horrifying thought. So the ocean has absorbed everything we've made. We make tens of thousands of new chemical compounds every year, and sooner or later these get into the ocean. They have a tendency to live there for a really long time and get admitted into the food web, so that's bad news. I'd also like to talk briefly about the other sort of the dead zone regions of the ocean, which are a pollution hot point. Mm-hmm. And these are areas that are primarily at the mouths of rivers. I spent some time out in the Gulf of Mexico at the mouth of the Mississippi River, and these are areas where a lot of a variety of problems create dead zones. It could be pesticides or rather fertilizers washing off agricultural lands. It could also be emissions from coal-burning industries. At any rate, the bottom line is you end up with areas of the ocean where, due to a variety of sort of domino effects, you end up with almost no oxygen in the water. Basically, you've created too many plants growing in the ocean. As those plants have died, all the decomposers have come, and their populations have grown in order to eat them, and those decomposers use up all the oxygen in the water. So imagine if you were in your car or in your office, and suddenly all the oxygen was sucked out of your world. Well, you'd try to run away. You wouldn't have very long before you'd be unconscious. And if you couldn't move for some reason, you'd just be dead. And this is what we see happening in these dead zones. There's currently 150 dead zones on planet Earth. The number is doubling every decade. So we're headed towards 300. The Gulf of Mexico dead zone is the second largest dead zone on Earth. It's larger than the state of New Jersey when it's in full bloom in the summertime. And there's nothing alive in it when it's underway, except for perhaps some jellyfish. So this is alarming. These are areas that are traditionally very rich fisheries. These are nursery grounds. These are really the epicenter of marine wealth, and we are actually destroying them by our practices on land. Now, again, the good news is scientists have ascertained that to fix, for instance, the Gulf of Mexico dead zone, you would only have to reduce fertilizer applications by 12% to 14% in the tributary areas of the Mississippi River. So the breadbasket of the U.S., yes. But 12 to 14%, they've said we could minimize wintertime fertilizer applications. They have a list of best management practices that would very easily take care of that 12 to 14%. But again, it takes the commitment of dozens of states to agree to this, to enforce this. It's an easy fix, but we seem to lack the political will to make it happen.
I wonder if there's some things you can say about coastal waters. One of the things that we know is that there has been, and I'm not sure if it's true of other countries, but certainly in this country it has been true that the coastal populations have grown significantly. And one can understand that. It's a nice place to live, but also that means people are moving into what are sometimes fragile environments and ecosystems. So that's sort of one sort of issue. But it also can produce additional pollution if you have those people producing all the various kinds of waste that they do. It's something there has been an effort to address, but is there concern about that, about just the fact that now we have more and more people who want to live near the water and who are moving near the water, and is that causing problems?
Yeah, I mean, there is definitely, as you put it, a large human populations on coastal areas. You are going to tax it for a variety of reasons, but I would say really the problems are, here's the amazing thing. These are very profound and enormous problems that the ocean is facing, but they all have simple solutions. We know what the problems are, and we know what the solutions are. We just haven't implemented them. So even with a lot of people, there will always be, you know, an effect from a lot of people, but we can mitigate a certain percentage of these effects, and yet, you know, we're not even doing enough of that yet. So that's the part. We know the problem. We know the solution. Somehow we have to make our elected leaders understand, and I would hope that collectively as a species we would reach a maturity level where we would recognize that this is stuff that we have to tackle for our own good, for our children, our grandchildren, and basically the future of our kind in the world as we know it.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Again, our guest is Julia Witte. She's a documentary filmmaker, has been making nature documentaries now for a long time, specializing in doing underwater work. And she is the author of a featured article in the new edition of Mother Jones Magazine. You can read it by buying the magazine. You can read it online. Questions here, welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I mentioned a couple of times that you're working on, or maybe close to finishing, a book on coral reefs. Can you talk about that? I guess this is something that I would have to say I don't really feel like I know a great deal about. Coral reefs, what makes them special, what their role in the ocean ecosystem is.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, they have a very small footprint. They cover less than 1% of the Earth's surface, but they probably are responsible for seeding an enormous amount of the 7/10 of the planet that is ocean. And the reason is that they are in tropical waters, and they are kind of, they're the coastal ecosystem of many, many tropical waters, not all, but many. And many fish either begin their life or spend some section of their life history, and fish are different from land animals in that they undergo radical changes, something like the moth and the butterfly change, and they live different segments of their life in very different forms. And many, many animals live some section of their life on a coral reef, or else the coral reef generates a section of their lifestyle that sends them way out and seeds the rest of the ocean. Also, coral reefs are, you know, very important. I mean, the tsunami of just over a year ago, we know that where there were healthy coral reefs, that gigantic tsunami wave did much less damage on shore. This is one thing coral reefs do, is they buffer the land from big storm surges and storm waves, whether they be from hurricanes and typhoons or from tsunamis. They also provide the majority of protein for people in the tropical world. So people who live in the tropical coastline, they depend on coral reefs really to maintain their nutritional levels. So they are extremely important. They are considered the rainforests of the sea, and in terms of overall importance in the global scheme, they may be more important to our planet than even rainforests. So it is very important that we try to maintain these, but they're under a variety of threats, and the most serious one is without a doubt global warming. Corals cannot live outside a very narrow temperature range, and as the global ocean warms up, they begin to suffer and eventually die, and we are seeing that happening across the globe right now, where we're having episodes of weakened coral reefs that come about during warmer water, and sometimes they can recover and regain health, but if that warm water goes on for more than a few days or a few weeks, the reefs actually will die. We are seeing now every few years sort of pandemics of coral death as a result of rising global sea temperature.
We have another caller here to talk with, someone listening in Watsika. Let's go there. This is our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, thank you. Mm-hmm. I was just listening a few minutes ago, and your guest mentioned about reducing fertilizer applications to help with what I assume was nitrogen that was flowing down the tributaries into the Gulf. And I was in an ag symposium a couple years ago, and conventional wisdom is that applied nitrogens are where that nitrogen is sourced from that gets down into the oceans. But there was a guy that was doing some basic research for the government at that time, and they were taking drain water from field piles in Iowa and experimenting to see what kind of nitrogen rates were coming out of those drain tiles, based on whether there had been nitrogen fertilizer applied or not, and they were finding that nitrogen application, at least in those circumstances, had very little impact on the amount of nitrates that were coming out of the drain water, and they were assuming from their results that the naturally occurring nitrogen being produced by the organic matter in those soils was actually the source for most of that runoff nitrogen. And the idea to think that we can greatly affect that, I think, might be where conventional wisdom is, but this guy's basic science was showing that that's likely not the case, and really the greater cause of that is just how well we drain the soils and make them productive, and it's actually the productivity created by the drainage that is the source of that N.
Well, my understanding, there are, this is a very complicated issue, and there are a lot of reasons that lead to the hypoxia or the oxygen-deprived areas that create a dead zone. But we do know that actually nitrogen fixation and the fertilization is definitely part of it. These issues only emerged with the post-World War II when we began to have synthetic fertilizers. There were not dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico prior to that time or anywhere else on Earth that we know of. I've heard some scientists talk about the fact that soybean production is actually very detrimental and creates, and maybe it's the, I don't exactly know the dynamic or the mechanism for that, but we also know that in other areas, for instance, I know in Tampa Bay, which has had a hypoxia problem, they know that car exhaust is now contributing to a dead zone there. So there are a lot of reasons, and I think in the breadbasket of the U.S., which is the area that's affecting the Gulf of Mexico dead zone, it's not just agriculture. We also know that there's a significant impact from feedlots and some of the, cattle, pig, and that kind of stuff, where these creatures are being grown in gigantic numbers in close proximity, and runoff from these areas is also adding to the problem. And that's one of the things the scientists have addressed in a lot of time. I mean, they've been studying this Gulf of Mexico dead zone for 20 years. It's the best understood, best known dead zone on Earth. And they have a very easy program that involves a little bit of all the industries in the breadbasket to reduce some aspect of whatever their activities are that contribute to this nitrogen running down the Mississippi River. And again, it would be very little from any given industry, and it should really be done. But so far, we haven't had a federal mandate to come in and make everybody do it, and therefore it's not happening. And that Gulf of Mexico dead zone is growing bigger with every passing year.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call. Others are welcome here. We certainly would have time to get in maybe one more person here in the time that remains. We have 4 minutes left. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just as a way of summing up, I guess I feel that, we've talked about a little bit about a number of different problems, but I guess I find myself going back to the point that we started with, the fact that, yes, periodically there are studies released and you see stories about things that affect the ocean, but generally speaking, it's not something that seems to get as much attention as, I know we talked about this at the beginning, but it just strikes me that it's significant that it's not something that it gets the amount of attention that land-based environmental concerns get.
It doesn't. And, we really need to change that. This article has gone out to an awful lot of scientists around the world, and a lot of feedback has come back in where they have been really grateful, because at least reaching the popular audience to let them know the magnitude of these stories. And in a lot of cases, the scientists themselves are not aware of certain aspects of what's going on inside the ocean beyond their own realm of expertise. So what I tried to do in this article for Mother Jones Magazine, which you can also read online at motherjones.com, is to bring together, these are little stories that trickle out, 10 pages into a newspaper, and I wanted to bring all those together and sort of connect the dots so that readers would understand, well, what happens when you add up all these stories? What does it amount to? What's the bigger picture that's going on? And really, we need to begin looking at these bigger pictures if we're going to mitigate the problems that are coming our way and hopefully reverse at least some of them.
Let's try and catch one more caller here in Indiana, Monticello, Indiana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I was wanting to know if they have ever addressed the issue of spraying yards in cities and urban areas where they apply fertilizer probably at, maybe 2x or 3x rate as to just agriculture being a problem.
That's an excellent question.
I think it certainly is. I think we certainly know that fertilizers applied to yards, golf courses, So it's not just, and I think that this is something obviously farmers are sensitive about.
Absolutely, and we're all, you know, that's what I'm saying. Just as the Gulf of Mexico Recovery Plan addresses all the users, we're all users. You know, we can't pretend we're not all users. And everybody who's, as your caller, you know, points out, anybody who's spraying their yard or fertilizing their vegetable garden or whatever they're doing needs to think carefully about how and when they use this stuff. Is there an alternative? Do they really need these things? What would happen if they didn't use it? We all have individual choices we make every single day. And I would just say a little bit of consciousness on our part could really help the whole system if we all maybe just occasionally say no to some of this stuff, try other methods. And that's it's certainly, we need to, if we're not personally responsible for our own actions, we can't really go out there and ask other people to change theirs. So I would say that all of this change begins with the individual. Make the changes within your own life, and then you can go out and talk to others.
Well, there we're going to have to leave it. If you'd like to read the article, The Fate of the Ocean, by our guest, Julia Whitty, she is a documentary filmmaker, has been making nature documentaries for a number of years now, specializing in underwater films, and her article, The Fate of the Ocean, is featured in the current issue of Mother Jones Magazine. You can read it in the magazine, or you can go online to motherjones.com, and you can read it there. And then one of these days, you can also read her book about coral reefs. When do you have an actual publication date for the book?
Yeah, that'll be spring of 2007.
All right, next spring. Well, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Programming here on AM 580 is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and the coffee bar. Focus is also made possible by a grant from Bodywork Associates, offering licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Bodywork Associates has opened a new office inside the Oasis Center in the Illini Union. That's just about it for us. However, I just want to mention one time here, that tomorrow morning on the show we'll feature a couple of archives from just earlier this year, both of them from February. In the first part of the program, Franz de Waal, who is a very well-known scientist who studies primates, particularly chimpanzees and a close relative of chimpanzee and us, the bonobo. And he's authored a book entitled Our Inner Ape, a leading primatologist explains why we are who we are, taking a look at the behaviors of these two animals that, as far as their DNA is concerned, is the closest thing there is to humans. He's a professor at Emory University in Atlanta. And in the second part of the program, we'll be broadcast a conversation with Mia Bloom. She is assistant professor of political science at the University of Cincinnati and is the author of a book entitled Dying to Kill, which takes a look at suicide terrorism and why it is that people would do that. That's tomorrow. Both archives. And we'll be back then live with new shows on Monday. We hope right now that you'll stay tuned, because coming up we have the usual mix of news and sports and weather.